10:06.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. We did a show about Amy Chua's parenting techniques when her Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom was first published. I interviewed Chua and her husband earlier this year on their book, The Triple Package, about three keys to success: a superiority complex, insecurity, and impulse control. Psychologist and MacArthur recipient Angela Duckworth has been a guest on the show a few times to talk about her theories about sustaining passion and working hard over long periods of time, something she calls grit. Our guest, Alfie Cohn, is pushing back against these ideas about kids and parenting, achievement, and success. He has a new book called The Myth of the Spoiled Child. He says, contrary to public opinion, parents are not more permissive and kids are not more narcissistic than in previous generations. And getting tough on young people is often counterproductive and can send a bad message. Alfie Cohn joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston, and it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back.
How do you define the word spoiled? If you're describing a kid that you think is spoiled, what are they doing?
Well, I want not to talk about the idea of getting a lot of stuff. That's a common definition of spoiled. I'm more interested in what is imputed to kids more generally about having too much say over their lives, a sense of entitlement, I suppose, and in general, just doing stuff that we find objectionable as older people. This is what is widely assumed to be true of children in general, because parents are widely assumed to be too permissive and coddling children. And that's what I want to try to take apart and look at more carefully in the book.
And what's so interesting, and it seems that older people have always said this about younger people.
Exactly.
A kid of the 60s, the boomers, we were narcissistic, we were lazy, we were self-indulgent, and now we're hearing it again. Why this sort of generational accusation?
Well, first, let's pause for a moment to understand the significance of what you just said. If every generation has accused children of being spoiled, unlike the good old days in the last generation, and we go back and find exactly the same thing being said then, that really should take the wind out of the sails of people who have this kind of aggressive nostalgia. You know, this sort of grumpy notion that things, the golden age is over. People, when they realize that these beliefs were held indefinitely going backward, should sit down and shut up, because they realize that, in fact, the notion that things are worse now simply isn't true. It says more about their values and personality as the observer than it does about children and parenting, which they purport to describe. I think part of this has to do with a more general notion that things were always better back then. And I think part of it has to do with a dark view of children that, unfortunately, has long been held by older people.
I wonder whether it also has to do with parental anxiety, whether it's, you know, worrying about whether your child, when they grow up, they're going to get a job and they can support their family. The country, the world has been through a lot in recent years, and whether that has fed, I think, perhaps legitimate concern on parents' parts about whether their kids are going to be okay.
Well, I think that fear is certainly there, and it may drive certain behavior and attitudes, but I'm not sure it explains what we're discussing right now, because I think a rational person who is fearful about his or her child's prospects might respond with a very different, more supportive and constructive attitude toward children. In other words, the traditional approach that relies on heavy-handed discipline, setting limits, telling kids what they have to do, being the boss of children, denying them any sense of autonomy, that doesn't equip children to do well in a troubled economy. It doesn't equip them to do well, period, because it turns out to have more to do with the parents' needs than the child's actual needs.
But it seems we're sort of caught then between these two poles. On the one hand, there's the sort of tough love parenting that you just described. And then I do think that there is the parenting of parents being very involved. I'm not saying overly involved, but very involved in their children's mm-hmm. lives. You know,
right.
we're sitting with them while they do their homework. My parents never did that when I did my homework. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we're getting a double message.
That's right. Or to put it differently, we're so convinced that we need to criticize indulgent parenting and spoiled children that we'll throw out accusations that are hard to square with one another. On the one hand, parents are under-parenting because they're permissive and let kids do whatever the hell they want. On the other hand, they're guilty of over-parenting, of being helicopter-parenting. You know, which is it? It seems like we don't even notice the potential inconsistency. Now, in terms of over-parenting, first, like with spoiling, there are virtually no good data to support any of these. That's why the umpteen magazine and newspaper and blog articles you'll find making these accusations always rely on carefully chosen anecdotes and quotations from other people who agree with the author. There's nothing to support the idea. How many parents sit down and, you know, with their kids to do their homework? We don't know. We just assume it's widespread. And it may be true only of a small, unrepresentative slice of parents. But to the extent it does go on and there's something disturbing there, I think, and I argue in the book, that it has more to do with parents' need to control their children than it has to do with the conservative narrative of indulgence. And if that's true, then it's really an extension of the what you call the tough love, which is much more about toughness than love, approach, than it does with something where parents are letting their kids get away with something and cushioning them from the blows of, I mean, this is what you hear constantly. It's become the conventional wisdom that kids don't experience failure, that they're ill-equipped to deal with the real world, and so on. We hear this endlessly, and interestingly, the people who make these accusations congratulate themselves on their courage in pointing out exactly what everyone else is claiming. But again, it's based more on ideology than it is on good data about A, what's actually going on in families, and B, what's actually in the best interest of children.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we had someone from a local university on the show a couple of years ago, and he described some students' parents renting apartments so that they could be close to their child attending a local university. And of course, that's the sort of classic definition of a helicopter parent. You're saying there are anecdotes, but there's no sort of big research that tells us that this is a big trend.
When we're talking about helicopter parenting of older children, and by the way, there's a classic study of a famous general, I'm forgetting offhand who it was, whose mother did exactly that,
right?
many years ago, renting that
Sorry
apartment.
To hear that for him, but anyway, yes,
yeah,
go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it's another way of debunking the notion that it's more true today than it used to be. So I hope that when that person told that story that was intended to make us roll our eyes, that you immediately said, what data do we have to suggest how pervasive this practice actually is? But instead, we let people get away with these claims. And when, in the last few years, we finally start to have researchers looking into it, here's what they found about helicopter parenting. Number one, it's really rare. Even the people who are very quick to condemn it have been unable to find many examples. That's why they have to keep recycling the same anecdotes in a media echo chamber to create a crisis out of thin air. Number two, helicopter parenting, even of the kind that does seem to be disturbing to some people, actually tends to be more of a plus than a minus in general. In fact, one national survey a few years ago found that college-age students whose parents were very closely involved in their lives fared better, both psychologically and academically, which I think is very interesting. And the third thing they found is that the effect of that kind of close parenting isn't a one-size-fits-all proposition. Its effects vary to some extent by ethnicity, by gender, by class. So, for example, children who were the first in their families to go to college tend to need a lot more support than they're getting. And sometimes when kids come from a background where interdependence is valued at least as much as independence, then our culture's relentless pursuit of self-sufficiency and individualism turns out to be a rather bad fit, and it doesn't serve their interests very well at all. That's a more nuanced, I think, look than the typical condemnation across the board of these damn parents who are on the phone with the kid's dean.
And I hear what you're saying, but do you think that there are, and I'm even thinking of my own relationship with my parents growing up, and in many ways on the weekends, especially on Saturday, they had no idea what I was doing, let me tell you. And yep. I think kids today have a more personal, intimate, interactional, if I can use that word, relationship with their parents. I think that they know each other a little bit more. Do you think there's some truth to that?
I haven't
can
seen
we know
data.
That?
Well, I don't know that we know that. I do. There are data showing that college students are in touch with their parents on a pretty regular basis. They text them often. They call them, they email them, and so on. But of course, being in close contact isn't the same thing as parents intervening on their children's behalf. Yet another distinction that's totally lost with the sort of tendency among critics to just disparage helicopter parents across the board. It may be true that they're in close touch, but you know, developmentally speaking, there's far more worry, or there should be far more worry, about children who are insufficiently supported by their parents than children who are too supported. And the question, even with the latter, is what's too much and as seen by whom? If the child doesn't feel constrained and constricted and smothered and welcomes the parental close contact, then we're really talking about the ideology of the critics who think that kids by the time they're 18 ought to be on their own. And that, again, says more about their values than about what grown kids actually need.
About a minute before our first break here, but do you think, and again, these are very broad questions, but
yes,
that's what I have,
sure,
that the parents are overly judgmental of each other, the parents are judging what other parents are doing and perhaps comparing whether they're doing it right or they're doing it wrong?
Yes, and sometimes we judge other parents harshly for behaviors with their children that we manage to excuse and even congratulate ourselves for when we engage in it with our own children. You know, judgment of parenting is an easy thing to do. You don't have to be an expert to say that's too much. What concerns me is the direction of the judgment, which in our culture is almost always coming from the point of view that says parents are insufficiently firm with their children, rather than judging parents for being too controlling. And in fact, the research suggests that it's excessive control, more of what I call a doing-to approach, as opposed to a working-with approach, that, if anything, we should be more concerned about. Because what kids need is support by asking the question, what do kids need and how can we meet those needs, not how do I get my kid to do what I want.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. And again, that's Alfie Cohn, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new book called The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting. You've heard a bit about what he believes about children and parenting. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. And apparently the general you were talking about is Douglas MacArthur. His mom had a house at West Point. Who knew? We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
Thanks to the thousands of you who responded during our recent spring membership campaign. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are very close to reaching the goal for the drive, and we will make it with your pledge of support. Consider pledging at the $120 level and get the WHYY picnic blanket as your thank you gift. We will invest your pledge dollars right back into the programs you expect from us. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org. Thanks.
Blonde hair, I'm Robin Young. An academic weighs in on the debate over Beyoncé.
To call Beyoncé a sex object, I think is simplistic and lazy because it assumes that simply what you wear defines who you are.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Alfie Cohn. He's written a book called The Homework Myth, Unconditional Parenting, and he has a new one called The Myth of the Spoiled Child. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you think about what we are talking about. One of the ideas, and frankly, one of the people that you have a problem with in this book, Alfie Cohn, is Angela Duckworth. And as I said in my introduction, she's been on the show a couple of times talking about her ideas about grit. She was a teacher, and she saw that some kids did better than others in the classroom, and she realized it wasn't really IQ, it wasn't social intelligence, wasn't talent. It was this idea of kind of a stick-to-itiveness, which she has called grit. What is your problem with that?
Well, first of all, the idea that there's more to academic success and success in life than just IQ, I think is clear. We've known that for a long time. But when Daniel Goleman wrote a book about this on emotional intelligence about 20 years ago, he listed the things that kids need in order to flourish, which included altruism and empathy, curiosity, the ability to love and be loved. But lately what's happened is that this idea of the limits of cognitive capabilities has taken a sharp right-hand turn. Nowadays, when people talk about how there's more than intelligence that's needed, it turns out that what we're getting is a recycled version of the Protestant work ethic. Kids need self-discipline and self-control. They have to defer gratification so they do what they're told to do instead of pursuing things they enjoy, and they need to keep at it no matter what. What we're hearing, as if it's a new idea with grit, is really just, you know, what we heard from Benjamin Franklin's aphorisms and Aesop's fables and the 19th century chant that was intended to make kids do their homework. Mm-hmm. If at first you don't succeed, try again. What grit tends to do primarily as a concept is to distract us from looking at structural issues. For example, what is it that kids are being told to do in school? Is it worth doing? Does it help them think deeply or merely to memorize facts for tests? Is it helping them to become excited about learning? Or is the point really just to get mindless obedience? Instead of asking those questions, purveyors of the grit narrative just say, we need to figure out a way to make kids persist at whatever they're being asked to do. And the research to support it is a lot less compelling the closer you look at it. Some of it is really pretty circular. It just shows that people who are persistent persist. And some of it shows that kids who do their homework no matter what, even if when it's not worth doing, tend to get better grades from the same teachers who assign them the homework. So I'm interested in looking at why we're so interested in making kids self-disciplined, which is a way of basically controlling themselves in order to do whatever the adults want them to do without the adults having to monitor them, instead of looking at broader issues of what would make kids happier and healthier, more creative, critical thinkers who are likely to make our society a better place.
But I could see grit in the hands of a creative an empathetic teacher, helping children to be resilient, that when they, you know, when they run into a problem, they can sort of figure out ways of navigating around the problem or solving it or turning to their friends to try to solve it together. I could see this being used in a classroom in a much more benign and even creative way.
Sure. If we start by asking what should kids be doing and work with kids instead of making decisions for them, about what goals are worth pursuing. And then when we arrive at that answer, then sure, there's a range of characteristics that help them to become more effective at it, and persistence is surely one of them, but not the only one, and not necessarily more important than some others. But the grit narrative turns this on its head. It doesn't say at what should one persist. It treats persistence as a goal in its own right, regardless of what the goal is. And frankly, you know, tyrants have lots of grit. People who are up to no good, I wish, had a lot less of it. Sure, in the hands of somebody with good values who works with kids instead of doing things to them, we want kids to be resilient. We want them to deal with setbacks, by all means. We also want them to have the ability to decide when to do that, rather than to treat grit as a capability that they should have and display no matter what the circumstance or the task.
But don't you think the kids and actually all people, there's a sense of accomplishment when you have tackled something that's really hard and you've figured out how to solve it and it feels pretty darn good?
It does, but it feels a lot better when you got to choose what it is you're doing and it's meaningful to you. So, for example, getting all 25 questions right on a worksheet that consists of memorizing facts no one cares about and you'll never need again after the test shouldn't make, and in fact usually doesn't make kids feel particularly good. But when kids are able to work at a sustained project, especially one they're doing with other kids, to answer a question that's personally meaningful, yeah, then we feel good about it. Not just because we kept at it, and not even just because we succeeded, but because we were able to, because our school encouraged us to pursue things that matter. It's telling that Angela Duckworth's new research is deliberately designing boring tasks in order to figure out how to make kids stay with them instead of doing stuff that they find more worthwhile, rather than asking, how do we change the schools in order to provide kids with the kind of tasks where they're going to feel an authentic sense of accomplishment instead of merely doing stuff the adults wanted them to do.
But do you think children then should choose whether to learn the times tables or not? Aren't there just some things in life you just sort of have to learn to do, whether you like it or not?
Well, I know a lot of successful people who have to think hard to remember what 7 times 6 equals, and they use their phone when they need to.
No, I understand
that.
But
that's the example a lot of people give, and even that example tends to dissolve under close inspection. Even if you want kids to learn multiplication, great teachers don't use textbooks and lectures and worksheets and quizzes. What they tend to do is embed those skills in mathematical tasks that are worth doing that require them to think deeply, project-based education. So even here, it turns out that when kids have an ability to help design the curriculum, they become more academically astute and proficient, but without losing that passion for learning. And when you have that real passion, you don't need to swallow grit in order to keep at it, even though you find it kind of tedious. In short, and this is something that I think eludes many conservative theorists like Duckworth, kids learn how to make good decisions by making decisions, not by following directions. And grit and self-discipline are all about ways to make kids follow directions.
It's interesting you've used the word conservative several times. I mean, that somehow there's conservative, well, this is, I guess, not the greatest revelation, but there are conservative ideas about parenting and liberal ideas about parenting. And you see grit and things like that as essentially conservative. Even you use the word puritanical.
Or the Protestant work ethic.
I think
that's what it is. It's what's fascinating. Frankly, what provoked me to write The Myth of the Spoiled Child was a really curious fact, which is that even people who are pretty liberal on most political issues suddenly sound like they're on Fox News when the conversation turns to children and parenting. where there's very little difference between people on the left and the right, and they're accepting the same conservative narrative that kids don't experience failure enough, they need more frustration, their self-esteem is inflated, they get trophies and praise for every little thing they do, the parents are indulgent. They're helicopter parenting, they're too permissive, they need more limits, and what they need is not self-esteem, but self-discipline, so they're able to put off things that they enjoy to get their work done and deal with the cold, cruel reality of the world that they'll be facing. These are conservative ideas, I think, unless you want to use another word like traditionalist, but they're also conservative in a different sense, in terms of the outcome or effects of these beliefs, which is that they suggest that the problem is with either children or human nature, and we need to fix the kid rather than looking at the broader systemic factors that leads to problems. I mean, Paul Tough, who wrote a book, who helped to make Angela Duckworth famous and talks all about self-discipline and so on. I mean, he actually says at one point, there's no better strategy for dealing with poverty than helping kids to become more self-controlled and grit, you know, as opposed to, say, Medicaid and public housing and food stamps. Literally, this belief says, don't look at our economic system when you see inequities. Look to figure out a way to make children comply with what they've been told to do and keep at it until they're successful.
And that's
that's a deeply conservative notion, whether it's, you know, labeled that way or not.
And that's Alfie Cohn, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child. And he has issues, problems with some of our previous guests that have been on the show, talking about ideas of grit. Paul Tough was on the show recently as well. And Alfie Cohn's book is subtitled Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I mean, you're talking, we're down here in Philadelphia, and you're talking about a city with a very high poverty rate, a city where something like almost half of students don't make it through high school and graduation. And there's a very, very real concern about the future of these children and trying to figure out how do you keep them in school. And perhaps what I hear from you is, you know, make school a fun place to be. But
well, not just fun. Make it a deeply, authentically engaging place to be, in part by bringing kids in on creating a democratic community in the classroom, something I've written about in other books. But, you know, if we ask the question, how do we get kids to buckle down and do whatever work they're given, whether it's worth doing or not? If we ask the question, how do we teach kids grit and self-control? Then we're not asking the question, how do we change the curriculum or the pedagogy?
And I'm assuming, and from your perspective, how do you get rid of standardized tests?
Oh, yeah, that's another area, because every hour that teachers have to spend making kids better at taking standardized tests is an hour not spent helping kids to be curious, creative thinkers, because standardized tests tend to measure what matters least. And, of course, test results tend to mirror income levels and so on. So the problems are far more economic than they are educational. And standardized testing, and especially high-stakes standardized testing, developed under the Bush and Obama administrations and devised in large part by the Gates Foundation, is not about improving learning. It's about raising test scores, which tends to undermine the quality of learning when schools in Philadelphia and elsewhere are turned into glorified test prep factories.
Let me get some callers in, and the phones have just exploded. We have Jack from, not surprised here, we have Jack from Newcastle, Delaware, joining us on Radio Times. Jack, go ahead. You are on the air.
I very much enjoy the conversation, but it seems to me mostly about education. But the family, which is, I think really produces a child, you see today is in disruption. It's not the modern family is not the traditional family. Usually if it's a single family with a mother in there, or a single mother family, the mother is at work. Laws as far as poverty goes, if she has to have a job, you know, fortune collect welfare, takes away. The children are brought up largely influenced by television. Welcome Back, Kotter becomes the school plan as far as how to behave. I find that children...
You're dating yourself there, Jack. That show hasn't been on a decade.
Yes, it is. But really, you see the absentee father because of poverty and things of that nature. So I think the family itself has suffered so much, and that's got to be taken into place.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Alfie Cohn, what do you think about what Jack just said?
Well, if the point is that we shouldn't blame schools or teachers for deeper societal issues, I agree with that, and I wish that more politicians would attend to it at that level of abstraction. But the notion that single-parent families are inherently problematic, I think, is harder to support with good data. And I think there are loving and supportive families. When there aren't, it has more to do with the fact that people are having trouble making a living, that even two-parent families, it's often necessary for both parents to take on multiple jobs and so on. That's not about a culture of poverty. That's about fixing an economic system in which jobs aren't created. So this takes us far afield because, in my book, I'm interested in approaches to raising children and accusations about children and parenting that are made regardless of the configuration of the family.
Jack, thanks for the call to Radio Times. In fact, Alfie Cohn, you talk about the word with in terms of parenting. Flesh that out for us.
Well, I use the label working with as opposed to doing to. And a working with approach to parenting is one that is not permissive. It's not indulgent, but it's one where when things go wrong, it's seen as a problem to be solved together rather than an infraction to be punished, where kids are given choices that are developmentally appropriate to help them learn to be good decision makers, and where, above all, kids know that they never have to earn our love. It's not about praising kids for being impressive or well-behaved or about punishing kids by forcibly exiling them, which we call time out, when they do something wrong. It's about saying to them, let's figure this out together, and let's help you to become a caring and responsible and happy and ethical person. That's different from ignoring kids and letting them do what they want, but it's also sharply different from the usual model proposed to us I call doing too, which is basically variations on bribes and threats to get kids to comply with whatever the adult wants. So it's easier to say reward your kids when they jump through your hoops or give kids a punitive consequence when they don't than it is to flesh out in a one-size-fits-all fashion how you deal with specific issues that vary from child to child, except in those general terms that I've described as working with.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation again. Alfie Cohn is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He has a new book. It's called The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting. And he's written a number of books about children and about parenting, including The Homework Myth and Unconditional Parenting. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, 12-time Major League Baseball All-Star Mike Piazza. He'll talk about his career, being inaccurately outed as gay, and the time he got a clubhouse call from Roger Clemens after the pitcher beaned him.
I was not in the mood to talk, so I basically told him where to put the phone.
Piazza's memoir is out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
General goes on the offensive.
Any allegation, any adverse incident like this makes me mad as hell.
VA Secretary Eric Shinseki before Congress as reports of adverse incidents at the VA proliferate. Next time, a whistleblower in Missouri on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Before you hit the polls on primary day, tune in to WHYY's Election 2014, this morning at 11 a.m., hosted by WHYY's Dave Davies and featuring reports from across the state. WHYY's Election 2014 is a comprehensive look at the Pennsylvania congressional and gubernatorial races, focused on the issues that matter to you: taxes, education, fracking, and more. WHYY's Election 2014, this morning at 11 a.m.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Looking at the book titles and article titles, it's easy to get the impression that kids today are selfish and overindulged and their parents are too permissive. And what is needed is tough love through adversity and failure. Our guest, Alfie Cohn, isn't buying any of this, and he writes about it in his new book called The Myth of the Spoiled Child. Let me get, looks like Michael from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this conversation is really great. I'm going to walk tomorrow, get my Master of Science in Pastoral Counseling at Newman University, and I've been studying William Glasser's choice theory in the guise of, you know, reality therapy. But what it sounds like you're talking about is the difference between what Glasser calls external control psychology versus choice theory. And I was wondering, he would say that the biggest indicator of what's going to work in the school is the relationship between the teacher and the student. In other words, students are, with whom teachers are in a good relationship tend to perform more. They get, they do more. So I think that in terms of the choosing, you know, that they would, they learn to make decisions by making decisions is a great point. But I also think that you can impart characteristics like what's being called grit through a good relationship with the student, because they're going to persevere in tasks with a teacher with whom they've got a good rapport. Anyway, well, that's the idea I want to throw out there and see what you've got.
I'm glad you did it, Michael. No, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Alfie Cohn, what do you think? Do we have Alfie Cohn?
Glasser, I think we agreed on many points. I would make two quick distinctions, though. One is, a good supportive relationship is very important in a classroom as it is at home. But if a child is doing stuff in order to please the teacher, that's really an extrinsic motivator, which is very different from finding the task compelling in its own right. And also, and I think also very relevant to parents, is the difference between internal motivation and intrinsic motivation. If I'm intrinsically motivated, it's because I get a kick out of what I'm doing or because I find it valuable in its own right. Internal motivation, though, may just mean that I've swallowed whole the constraints and commands from outside. So there are a lot of internally motivated kids, especially teenagers, who don't have to be rewarded or punished anymore by an adult standing over them, because they have swallowed whole that imperative to achieve at any price. And some of them are basket cases psychologically. Some of them are workaholics in training, who are joyless even though their motivation is internal. That's why I think it's not enough to talk about self-discipline or internalization. We have to look at the fuller picture, psychologically speaking, of helping kids to be whole people who are integrated and fully committed to the things that they're doing.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So just picking up on that, and you sort of deconstructed what a relationship is about. But, yeah. I mean, it seems to me that and I don't know the research here, but from my own experience and experience of my son going to school, is that those relationships, whether they were intrinsic or extrinsic, is that a word? I'm not sure.
Extrinsic, yes.
Extrinsic,
right.
Okay. But the relationship did matter. I mean, that was whether you wanted to please the teacher or not, that relationship mattered.
Well, maybe this can help explain why I'm a little worried about just pleasing the teacher or the parent, but at the same time agree with you and the caller strongly about the importance of relationships. What characterizes a healthy, supportive relationship from a parent or from a teacher largely, is unconditional support, which means I care about you no matter what. I value you for who you are, not for what you do. And when kids feel that unconditional support, even when they screw up or fall short, they know that that support from the adult isn't going to be diminished. That empowers them to be more likely to reach out to others, to have their needs met, so they aren't really just hearing their own needs offering a deafening clatter in their ears, and to pursue things and take risks and become more resilient, and yes, even to persist at tasks. Unfortunately, you see how I worked that in there?
I did, yes.
But I think the important thing there is to realize that most of what we're hearing in terms of a conservative critique in America about parenting that's become the mainstream wisdom is to make our acceptance conditional, that kids have to do more to earn a sticker that we give them, or a congratulations, or a trophy, or even self-esteem. That's the heart of the furious counter-reaction that kids today feel good about themselves even when they haven't shown adequate accomplishments to merit that self-esteem. And that's precisely the opposite of what research has found kids need to flourish, which is an unconditional sense of I'm valuable no matter what. That doesn't mean I have a sense of grandiosity or I don't understand my limitations, but it's paradoxically that unconditional self-acceptance, which comes from unconditional support from a parent, that permits me to acknowledge my mistakes and my foibles and to move on.
Do you have kids?
I do, two.
Two. And this is how you raise them?
I hope so. I mean, I don't always succeed. I don't always show the patience I hope and the unconditionality that they deserve. But this is certainly the North Star by which I navigate, and that's supported by my own experience as a parent, as well as the experience of other parents and what the research says.
We have a Facebook comment from Deidre. She says, I'm so confused. I always thought of myself as a helicopter mom with a very conservative approach to parenting. Can I be both?
It depends on how you define those terms, I guess. I'm not sure. I don't know why she wants to be a conservative parent or what she means by that. What kids need is to know that we're there for them. But if you're being a helicopter parent because you need them to need you, that's a problem. If you're being close and giving them more support than your neighbor thinks you should give them, and it seems to be working well, and it seems to be psychologically adaptive, then ignore your neighbor.
Let me get Julia from Chester County to join our conversation. Julia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, my name's Julia Sherwin. I am a parenting columnist with the Daily Local News based in Westchester. And I kind of feel that, you know, my parenting sort of falls on both sides of the equation. And I have a Facebook group that I sort of put some questions out to, some things like, you know, do you pay your children for getting good grades and things like that. And I find the intrinsic motivation, you know, a really important thing for children. And I definitely feel like as a parent, I foster that with my children by, you know, really working with them. I am a stay-at-home mom as well. So, you know, I'm really front and center with their activities. But I'm curious, Alfie, what do you feel about democratic schools where I guess, you know, the students and the children sort of choose their own curriculum?
Julia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Alfie Cohen, go ahead.
The quick answer is, my educational philosophy is more informed by the work of people like John Dewey and Jean Piaget and others who talk about a progressive education in which the adult plays a very active and interactive role. Not an authoritarian role, but not a hands-off, laissez-faire role either, where the kids just do what they want. For me, when I talk about a more democratic classroom, I'm not talking about one where the teacher isn't involved and the kids just pursue their own activities, but one where there's a back and forth reciprocal relationship and the teacher and the kids work together to form a set of guidelines as well as a curriculum. I've said much more about this in an earlier book called The Schools Our Children Deserve. I appreciate the question.
Thanks for calling in, Julia. Let me see what looks like Deanna from Westchester, Pennsylvania has to say. Deanna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. So my question is, I used to homeschool my children, and because of the economy and everything, both my husband and I are now working, and both of my kids are in public school. And so my question is, how do we as parents help our children and work with their teachers to help them be able to find activities and work that is more meaningful, or do we just need to do that supplementally? Is it just too difficult given the system that they're working within?
Deanna, thanks for the
question.
Yeah, go ahead,
on the teacher. Sorry. That depends on the teacher and the school. Sometimes you can happily support what it is the teacher is doing, and other times you may have to supplement or even in a respectful but firm way challenge what's going on. Sometimes if the teacher is just focused on getting obedience in the classroom and using reward and punishment systems to that effect, or is mostly focused on getting kids to memorize forgettable facts so that they'll do well on a quiz or a standardized test, that can kill kids' curiosity. If the teacher is giving lots of homework, forcing the kid to work what amounts to a second shift, even though research fails to support the value of doing that, especially before high school, then you may need to work with other parents to question and challenge the system instead of treating it as if it's like the weather. So you have to, in the short run, minimize the damage that's done to the child to immunize him or her against a system that's not ideal. And in the long run, move to work to change that system. That's if it's not going well. Hopefully, in many classrooms, it will be.
Deanna, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We've talked a lot about teachers and classrooms, Alfie Cohn, but I just feel like teachers are so on the front line and so, you know, such a target for criticism from almost all sides now. Do you have sympathy for them?
I do indeed. I used to be one. I certainly do have that kind of sympathy, especially when teachers are being bashed now and blamed for problems that, A, are more the result of educational policies imposed on them and kids from above that have more to do with focus on economic imperatives, global competitiveness, instead of about what's good for children, with standardized testing up the wazoo, and B, issues that have to do not with education at all, but with political and social and economic realities that make it impossible for teachers to reverse those problems with what they do in the classroom. And so teachers, and it's more politically adept to blame them, their unions, and bash the unions for this, are often forced out of the classroom or turned into test prep technicians instead of professional educators. I have terrific sympathy for them, and I'd like to see parents and teachers working together to organize to oppose the kind of corporate, quote, reform in education that is actually squeezing the intellectual life out of our children's schools.
Let me get Kathleen from Leesport, Pennsylvania to join us. Kathleen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. I'm a parent of three teachers, actually. One is in elementary school and two are in high school. It seems that the teachers are being held so accountable for the results of standardized tests in their classrooms, and there really isn't any room for a child to be encouraged to have a democratic classroom in your definition.
Yeah.
And also, there is no room in the curriculum to teach critical thinking, which I think is a detriment to our entire country.
Well, I know. It's so true.
And I was wondering if you had any ideas on how to change that, because it seems that it is a political issue.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Alfie Cohn.
Yeah, I mean, I've written this book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, talks about this only glancingly. I've written about this issue at some length, and there's a lot of hands-on stuff for parents on my website, which is, if I may, AlfieCohn, AlfieKohn.org. But I'll give you one quick idea, which is if you have school-age children and you doubt whether your child's capacities and talents are captured by a test score, or you're concerned about how much time is being given over to preparing kids for standardized tests, why the hell would you let your kid go to school to take the tests? Mm-hmm. By doing that, you become the accomplice of people who know almost nothing about how children learn. And there's a growing movement across the country for parents to say, I'm going to opt my child out until the people responsible for this corporate-style, test-driven, heavy-handed approach to school reform figure out that higher test scores are actually symptomatic of worse schooling. So boycott the tests is one quick answer. But, of course, there's much more work to be done in the long hand, in the long term.
Kathleen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We actually did a show about the opt-out movement. And, Alfie Cohen, about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but I turned to something at the end of your book about a recipe for reflective rebelliousness. And
yes,
you want children to take risks to do what they think is right. Give us a 45-second
response.
Even if
it were true. Even if it were true that kids were too self-centered, you don't respond to that by making them more mindlessly obedient. You respond to that by pulling them out of themselves so they attend to the needs of others and how to create a whole society that's more compassionate and just. So in the last chapter of the book, I encourage parents to think about how if we want kids to be assertive and we want them to be morally sophisticated, we have to welcome their pushback against us sometimes and their questions of all authority, including parental authority, so they can be courageous people who make their culture a little better than they found it. So I end up there with that notion of reflective rebelliousness. Whether or not it's true that kids are too self-centered today, that seems to me a pretty good prescription for creating a better tomorrow.
Well, we have to end on that note. To Alfie Cohen, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times to talk about the myth of the spoiled child.
Thanks for having me.
And you're very welcome. And we do want to close things out with a song from Bye Bye Birdie. It's from the original Broadway cast and a song called Kids. And it features Paul Lind. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.
Kids, I don't know what's wrong with these kids today. Kids, who can understand anything they say? Kids, they are disobedient, disrespectful oafs, noisy, crazy, sloppy, lazy loafers. And while we're on the subject, kids, you can talk and talk till your face is blue. Kids, but they still do just what they want to do. Why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way? What's the matter with kids today?